Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that, as advertised, looks for quality cinema wherever we can find it. Sometimes that means we have to wait a long time, as evidenced by the release of films delayed by the COVID-19 pandemic. Films such as the latest James Bond adventure, No Time to Die, and just this past week, Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of Frank Herbert's award-winning 1965 science fiction novel, Dune. We're going to discuss Dune before moving on to Golden Voices, which is a little movie about the problems faced by a Russian couple immigrating to Israel. Let's begin this week's show by heading to the mystical desert world of Arrakis. There have been a few previous efforts to bring Frank Herbert's novel Dune to the big screen, most notably David Lynch's critically panned 1984 big screen adaptation, starring the likes of Kyle MacLachlan and the rock star Sting. Now we have a version directed and co-written by Denis Villeneuve, the French-Canadian filmmaker whose previous science fiction efforts, including Arrival and Blade Runner 2049, were enough to give fans of Herbert's novel hope that he might get the story right. And while the plot that Herbert dreamed up is so vast, so sprawling, and so entwined with Middle Eastern religious and political references that no film could ever do it full justice, Villeneuve's effort comes the closest yet. Starring the likes of Timothée Chalamet, Rebecca Ferguson, Oscar Isaac, Zendaya, and a number of notable actors cast in secondary roles, including Oscar winner Javier Bardem, Villeneuve's Dune is wisely only the first half of the novel. Dune Part 2 is said to be in pre-production. The pared-down storyline, augmented by state-of-the-art computer graphics, makes this Dune at least somewhat comprehensible to those unfamiliar with what Frank Herbert put on the page.
And I think that when we're discussing this movie, it's almost necessary that each of us will probably have to explain our familiarity with Dune going into this movie, because there are people that have been waiting, in some cases, decades to finally see a faithful version of this novel on the big screen. And from what I understand, fans of Dune really like this one, and fans of Dune are also, they're the ones that are taking a microscope to this thing to see, you know, did they get all of the aspects of this, as you said, sprawling universe right? And my history with this is I've never read any of the Frank Herbert books. I tried reading Dune once. It got really popular when I was in high school for some reason. I think it was around the time that the TV miniseries that attempted to adapt this came out. And so I tried reading it around then, and I couldn't get into it. This kind of science fiction, this like big world building, all these characters in different houses and they're all kind of related, has never really been my jam. And so I've always kind of resisted Dune as a property. And I only recently saw the David Lynch version. And maybe we can talk about that because the contrasts here are pretty wild. And so I feel like I am all alone on my own desert planet here because I just could not get into this movie. I couldn't get into Villeneuve's Dune. I found it just stultifying and cold and just interminable. And people seem to really love this. I mean, if my social media is any indication, everyone is coming out of this thing, whether they're watching it in IMAX, which is how I saw it, or they're watching it in HBO Max at home. They seem to be really awe-inspired by it. And I wish I saw that movie. I almost feel like I saw a totally different movie from everybody else that's raving about it, because I can't follow this story. There's something about this story that just doesn't click with me. I certainly couldn't follow it in the Lynch version, which makes no sense at all. And this, I at least was able to kind of parse out the basics, you know, what spice is and which planet is which and why people want the spice and who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. Because Villeneuve is, as a craftsman, is very good at taking complex cerebral ideas and making them palatable for mainstream audiences. And I have to say, I admire the fact that this movie, which is cerebral and has, you know, a lot of big ideas and isn't exactly your typical multiplex fare, is doing so well and has found a mainstream audience. I assumed this thing would bomb like the original one did, because I didn't know that people would embrace Dune the way that they have. So I almost feel like I'm not the right person to review this movie because I don't get it. I didn't really find much to like about it. A handful of arresting images. The cast is really good. And I mean, and I've loved pretty much everything Villeneuve has done in the past, including Arrival and Blade Runner 2049. Yeah, this just didn't do it for me. So maybe we'll Well, now we move on to Mary Pat, who you're not a sci-fi person at all. So
no, I'm
really
not a sci-fi
curious
person
to know what you
at
think
all,
about
but
this.
I think my larger complaints have to do with the theater in which we happened to see the film.
Yeah, we didn't see it in IMAX.
Right, and we didn't see it in Dolby, but we did see it at the AMC in theater number 10. So if you get your ticket,
you remember the number.
Theater number 10, please run, because there's something wrong in that theater. Everything is like super, super dark.
Mm-hmm. Right. You've complained about the darkness
of certain movies.
I've complained to the theater and nothing gets
done. Right. So they also show 3D movies in there, and I think they don't take off that filter when they're showing regular films. So I'm not sure we had the complete viewing experience.
No, we certainly did not.
But yes, I must say that for someone who does not like science fiction, who did not read the books, but did see the David Lynch film, I actually appreciated much about Dune, and you left out the most important thing about Dune, this version, Nathan, which I think is the fact that it has Timothée Chalamet, who is the most beautiful boy ever. And so
he's got
that
bone structure.
I can just look at him forever and ever and ever. And I'm not even sure that he's an actor, but he's certainly this.
He has a presence about him.
He does have a presence about him.
The camera loves that kid.
Right. And so that's, I think, a highlight of this film. Zendaya, if anybody's a Zendaya fan, please be on notice that she's on the screen for fewer than 10 minutes. And so I think that
And mostly in dream sequences, yeah.
Right. And so please be mindful of that because she's done a lot of publicity and so forth. So you would think that she was, you know, out of the 2.5 hour movie, you would think that she would at least be on screen for 2 hours of that. And
I assume she's all over Dune Part 2.
Yeah, I would assume because then we're going to transition to that part of the story. But I think that Dune was, in its incarnation in the written word, was sort of groundbreaking in that this is the, like, 60s, and Frank Herbert was really focused on these environmental themes. And I think that he, as you said, being a Washingtonian, we were talking about this earlier, he really took a lot of his ideas and concerns, some might say from a friend, but definitely from the Indian tribes of the Western Washington area, most notably the Ho. And as a result, I think that this was an important contribution to sort of popular culture at the time. And it did, as you said, Nathan, have a lot of aficionados, and I don't know what they would think about this. It's hard, if you've seen the David Lynch Dune, it's hard to erase that one from your mind because it's truly one of the more bizarre cinematic experiences that one could have.
Well, I want to say that it's funny to me that of all the completely impenetrable Dreamworld movies that David Lynch has made, maybe his least coherent is Dune, which is his biggest budget movie.
Well, it was let's face it, it was taken out of his hands.
It was an Alan Smithy film.
Right,
he removed his name from it.
Wouldn't it have been great if we could have seen Alejandro Jodorowsky's version, which we reviewed a documentary about his loss.
And that's
Dune.
Really worth seeing. I mean, if you want to see how this book and how the world that Frank Herbert created has enraptured people, that's probably the best example of it because Jodorowsky became so obsessed with the world of Dune and how he could translate it to the screen that it consumed years of his life and a project that that he had the hubris to think could ever get made. I mean, he wanted it to be, what, like 18 hours long?
Or something like
Salvador
that.
Dali
this
was
way
be
before
it.
Television miniseries.
Right.
Well, like Mary Pat, I'm more of a fan of this movie than you are, Nathan. I read the book. I don't even want to say how many decades ago. And I also saw the Lynch movie, though I missed the miniseries. I'm a big fan of Villeneuve, of all his movies, but particularly the two movies, his two science fiction movies that we've mentioned, Arrival and Blade Runner 2049. And as Mary Pat pointed out, we didn't see the best version of it because it looked like it was shot through a dirty, wet sheet.
Like there was sand on the lens.
It was just wretched. I was so upset. But in terms of the filmmaking itself, in terms of the performances, I thought they were all fine. I liked Oscar Isaac much better here than I did in the Star Wars movies. He plays it as a dramatic actor, which is what he is. In the Star Wars films, I just think that he's completely out of his depth. The one complaint I do have about Villeneuve is I didn't like his fight scenes. There's a lot of fight scenes here, as there are in the Star Wars movies, of which this movie is, Dune is very similar. So, George Lucas, we know where you got your inspirations. But while much of the computer graphics are terrific, they're as good as you're going to see, the fight scenes themselves are just a bunch of ho-hum, jumpy, jerky. Even Jason Momoa, it's like, dude, what is going on?
Well, Jason Momoa seems like he's, speaking of being on other planets, is like in another movie.
I
from
know.
Everyone
oh,
else.
What about Stellan Skarsgård?
Yeah.
Channeling his inner Marlon Brando.
Yes,
he's channeling
looks like
his inner
Kurtz.
David Lynch version of Marlon Brando.
And those were the two performances that I think I gravitated most towards because Jason Momoa seems to be having fun. Like, he's really excited to be in the universe. Yeah. And Stellan Skarsgård is just going, like, he's playing some kind of horror movie villain, like something out of the David Lynch version of Dune. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, the technical mastery, yes, I can't fault any of it, but that's all I saw. And at the end, I was supposed to feel some kind of emotional something, and I just felt totally distanced from this thing.
But this is a movie that kids can go see, and
okay.
So I think.
Well, I don't have kids, so I don't care about that.
You are a kid.
You don't.
Anyway, that was our review of Dune, and this is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcast Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the Magic Lantern offering Golden Voices. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
We say this often, because it's an important fact about public radio. Everything you count on from us. Trusted news, in-depth features, conversations, music, and culture. Depends on your support. In moments of challenge, possibility, and progress, public radio is a sound, trusted source of information. And that means your participation is more necessary and powerful than ever. Please help SPR meet these momentous times with your generous support so we can be there for you today and for generations to come. It's easy and secure. Just click the red donate bar at SpokanePublicRadio.org, fill out a brief form, and emerge a new member. You'll be glad you did whenever you turn on your radio. And thanks.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Maripat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of the science fiction novel Dune. Let's now move to something completely different, Golden Voices. Beginning in 1980 and over the next two decades, some 2 million Jewish people immigrated from Russia to Israel. Among the many who came following the lift of immigration restrictions in 1989, according to this Israeli movie directed and co-written by Evgeny Ruman, were Viktor and Raya Frenkel, minor stars in their homeland, having made careers by dubbing the voices of actors in non-Russian films. The Frenkels struggled to find themselves in their new setting. Moreover, Raya, played by Amaya Belkin, gradually begins to rankle at the controlling nature of Viktor, played by Vladimir Friedman, when she finds a job as a phone sex operator and he gets involved in a scheme to dub illegal bootleg copies of newly released movies. Their relationship comes to a head. Though it has a few laugh-out-loud sequences, Golden Voices is not nearly as cloyingly comic as you might expect. It ends up being, in fact, a serious study of two aging people having to re-examine what their mutual life has been and what, if anything, will keep them together.
I would characterize Golden Voices as a heartwarming film with, as you point out, Dan, some different opportunities to look at aging, to look at society in Israel, to look at the displacement of Russian Jews who emigrated. And so I think that the movie does a good job of presenting a storyline and then touching on these other topics that probably could have been more of a focal point but would have changed the movie completely. This film is a little movie, but it works because of the performances of the two lead actors. And I think they themselves emigrated from the Soviet Union to Israel, so they share something in common with the characters that they're playing. And it's sort of how do immigrants find their footing in this new world? And I think that that's sort of where the movie kind of starts out, because we're introduced to their nephew, Boris, now Baruch, who sort of just puts them in this apartment and leaves them there. And the apartment's perfectly suitable, but they don't really know how to work anything or do anything. And then in their 60s, they still have to make money to survive and to get by and so forth.
Pay their rent.
And of course, they gravitate to their former profession, which was being voiceover actors, as you point out, Dan. But of course, we know exactly where it's going when our lead character, Raya, finds this ad in the newspaper that once someone was looking for women who can do different voices and so forth. I mean, we know exactly where that's going. And although she doesn't catch on right away, she eventually ends up getting into it and finds...
She's good at it.
Yes, and she's really good at it. And I'm sure that...
Margarita.
Right. I'm sure that people may think that they're talking to a tall, hot blonde, and it's actually Raya, who is not. But... it sort of shows the isolation that people feel. And that relates to not only our two lead characters, but also the people who are calling this line, because they are Russian speakers. And so we find out that there are these illegally dubbed movies into Russian, the Russian language, so that people have some connection with culture, entertainment, and so forth. Of course, we know that music is a universal language, so that exists and so forth. But the film, I think, in the end, really is about relationships. Relationships of these two people, the relationships to your cultural community, and so forth.
Yeah, it's tempting to call Golden Voices like a small film because it's about these two modest characters. It's only about 80 minutes long, clearly a low budget production. But I was impressed by just how much, and I think you touched on it pretty well, Mary Pat, how much is going on in this story, how many big themes it's tackling in a short amount of time without ever feeling overstuffed.
Right.
Because I mean, it's about this specific period of time in Israel, 1989, 1990. It's about the displacement that these people feel. It's about their marriage possibly dissolving through this tumultuous thing. It's about the individual pursuits that they're finding.
And it's about the Middle East and the situation in the Middle East.
But then you have all of these wonderful subplots where Raya sort of begins this friendship, maybe something more, with this eccentric guy that keeps calling. And he's a character that kind of comes in the third act of this movie and enlivens it. And then you have all the business about the movie pirating that's going on. And there's this whole business involving this Fellini film that they want to premiere. There's all of that stuff happening in the background. And so even though this does seem like a very small scale kind of personal drama, there's a lot going on underneath the surface.
Yeah.
And I thought that the way that this director handled all of this was really adept and subtle in a way, because it would be really easy to either make everything very arch, to make everything very morose, and it would be easy to blow this thing up so that it was it was epic in scope or wasn't about anything at all. And so I think it strikes the right balance with all of this material.
And there's a real trick that filmmakers have in which they're able to reveal what the characters are and what their motivations are without exposition, without unnecessary exposition. We learn about Victor's controlling nature and how that affects Raya, just in how he sets her up to take photographs in front of the theater, in front of the airplane, whatever. And we also learn about him because, as somebody tells him, you know, Kirk Douglas was terrible. Spartacus was a wretched movie, but you made it great.
Because of
so
your dubbing.
That's his lost. That's what he's having to deal with, because now he's in Israel having to deliver little hand messages and poke them on windows.
Yeah.
Handbills, right, exactly. So
There's also this great scene where he's talking about, he's basically trying to convince the people that he's working with that he did have this great career back in Russia, and he recites Dustin Hoffman's monologue from Kramer versus Kramer.
Exactly.
As it's showing in
Russian,
the background.
Yeah, as it's playing in the background. And then they turn up the volume and they realize that's his voice.
Yes.
And there's wonderful little moments like that. So the fact that this is, in a way that you don't expect, a movie about movies, but it's only one of, you know, 10 different plots that's going on here.
Yeah, it was so easy to come into Golden Voices and think, as Mary Pat called it, a heartwarming film. But it's heartwarming, but it's also bittersweet. It's also expansive in theme. It's a much, much better movie than I thought it was going to be.
Well, and also, this is a commentary on actors and what it means to be an actor, because it's almost as though they didn't really know who they were anymore when they had been providing the voice for Kurt Russell and for Dustin Hoffman. So who were they? I think that Raya sort of slips more readily into her former persona by doing the work that she's doing as an actress, because Nathan, as you point out, she's really good at it.
Yeah.
And that was when I said laugh out loud moments. That is the moment when we see her change and start to embrace this. Mary Pat and I were just laughing out loud because she was so good at it.
Well, you think you know what this movie, Golden Voices, is going to be. I mean, you see these two characters and you go, I know who he is. I know who she is. She gets the job at the phone sex line and you go, oh, okay.
Yeah, I know where
this is going. This is going to be one of those, you know, quirky foreign comedies. And then he starts pirating movies. There's also a funny physical gag where I think that they go see Pretty Woman and they have their giant VHS camcorder and they prop it up and then a couple sits in front of them and starts making out and it ruins their bootleg. So you think that you know what this movie is going to be. And then it keeps kind of in an odd way redefining itself.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's a moment at the end, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a moment at the end where you think, oh, here comes the manufactured crisis, the manufactured moment of melodrama that everything is going to hinge on. And then it isn't that. It's something much more subtle and human. And I think I sound more enthusiastic about this than I was.
Yeah.
I didn't love this movie by any means, because I do think, even though it's dealing with a lot of stuff, it probably could have benefited from another 15 or 20 minutes.
But
it's really solid.
Right. And I think that this is a perfect art house film.
Yes.
So this is screening right now at the Magic Lantern. And I hope it does get an audience, because it really is worth watching.
Yeah, it feels like one of those movies that maybe in another time could have become kind of one of those sleeper art house hits that kind of like
out.
The Band's Visit or something like that kind of comes out of nowhere and really enchants people. It's not a well-known movie. I didn't know what it was until it opened at the Magic Lantern.
Yeah, we had to use the Google.
Yeah, but I'm glad I saw it.
Yeah. And that was our review of Golden Voices, which is playing at the Magic Lantern Theater. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Dune. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the late Frank Herbert. There is no real ending. It's just the place where you stop the story. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.